This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Managing Director of Operations for the new Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan is a seasoned veteran of the data industry. We talked yesterday with David Hood about the experience that he brings to the position and the latest about this massive project that's along the lakefront in Hammond. For folks that are not familiar, Mr. Hood, with your work, know that you've spent a lot of time working in telecommunications and in data center management, but in your most recent jobs have been in Chicago. What does a data center manager really do?
Well, at the most basic level, we keep all the blinking lights green. We mitigate any errors, any potential threats to data transmissions and compute power and a home user, say, we make sure that their connection to either Netflix, YouTube, whatever they're connecting to is maintained so that it doesn't go down and they have any outages.
Now, a lot of your work, I know, has been working with the telecommunications infrastructure, which certainly fits this very well. Interested you, number one, in what this job potential might be compared to what you were doing over in Chicago?
Well, considering this whole project, the ability to maintain people's connectivity, but do it in a more environmentally friendly manner is certainly a big draw. The facility we have here has the potential to utilize a lot more green power than a lot of data centers in the area. Frankly, there's just an easier, say more flexible environment in which we can create and additionally maintain green power and do it economically as well. Just the ability to work with the state of Indiana has been great as well, but the real key besides all the help the legislation's given us is the green power piece and being able to do that in the right way this time.
When you talk about being able to take a project like what you've worked on in the past in Chicago and other places and basically follow along, I guess, to a point in the same sort of operation that's being proposed here along Lake Michigan, but with this new component, the green energy part of it, is that probably the newest and the most exciting part of what you're going to be doing?
That is correct. I would say everybody wants to have the data centers up and running, but it takes a lot of energy to do that, and it can take energy from coal plants just to get it done. We're trying to avoid that as much as possible, and like I said, just the ability to utilize wind, the solar aspect of being able to provide power for this, and our managing members' design theory behind consolidating all these power sources, renewable and traditional power, is just very exciting and kind of a neater project to work on than just a normal data center. It's almost as exciting as building a data center, say, in Iceland, where every power is really cheap and the cooling is free.
And of course, in a way here too, you've got the advantage of being right next to this big lake, which will cool things very nicely too, right?
Very nicely, yes.
When you had a chance to sit down and talk with Peter Feldman and with Tom Dokich of Digital Crossroads, and I guess in some of your discussions you had, what did they say that seemed to interest you the most about this project?
The availability of the water and then just space to do the green power. And that's a good question from Pete for a great many years. And they've always had various projects that involve the green power aspect. So it's been an ongoing discussion, and gratefully they've involved me in some of those discussions over the years. So, the minute this was brought up, it was just a renewal of an ongoing discussion that was just as exciting as it was, maybe 10 years ago when we first started working together.
So he's followed through in a lot of his projects and other cases, perhaps, that with the green concept, and this is just the latest generation of that?
That is correct, yeah. Yeah, it's always been one of the top pieces on his agenda to get a data center as green as possible.
Any contact with what this tech incubator is going to be doing?
We haven't had much time to discuss that quite yet due to the nature of getting a building and a project started, but we're looking forward to those discussions.
What can you tell us on the latest on the construction that is underway for the building along the lake right now?
Maybe just foundation going now, the rest of the actual construction of the building about to become officially, I guess it's officially underway, but you know, things just ramp up and we're really gathering some steam now. And once that is, say, fully rolling and then, you know, we have walls up, we'll be able to start paying a little more attention to some of these other things like the tech incubator.
You're obviously going to have most of your space dedicated to the data center itself and all of the specialized equipment that it has to go in there. And then, of course, you've got, I guess, a very, very special, very, very green HVAC system, I guess, to put in there too, don't you?
It just takes a lot of airflow, and we're gonna have a lot of airflow to accommodate that between that and the lake water, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is also planned on the outside on the property there? You'll have a lot of extra room to work with, and you have a lot of space, luckily, that you'll have to be able to plan for the future and any future expansion. What else, at least in this first phase of the data center project, are you hoping to take advantage of along Lake Michigan?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question.
Have spent a lot of time on the building itself, I guess, and this is some nice things you can kind of sketch out in your mind and on paper and look to the future for.
There's just so much possibility here that even like the tech incubator, we are looking forward to the next 6 months when we can start looking towards the future and get past the initial first phase, building and getting that off the kind of off the drawing board and out onto the field. There's quite a few things that, you know, just you potentially wind power, what we talked about, the solar aspect, the amount of lake cooling, all those things, and just for phase two, how to more efficiently utilize these aspects and not just the phase one stuff, but really fine-tuning it to make it work right and make it work better than, say, any other data center around. So there's a great deal of opportunity here. It's just going to take us a little bit of time to get through all the possibilities and, like I say, fine-tune what we really want to do with the potential here.
We're talking with David Hood. He is the new Managing Director of Operations for the brand new Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan, the data center that is currently under construction along Lake Michigan in what used to be the footprint of the old state line generating plant that used to produce electricity, and now will take advantage of the best in the green energy to create electricity and keep the lights on and the equipment running. I know that you're probably working more closely with Peter Feldman and maybe with Tom Dockich about initial employment plans or how many folks you want to have once the facility is built and up and running.
Yeah, ultimately we're going to have around 40 to potentially 50 people employed in the building directly in various aspects of managing the site. Just having a data center is going to expand. You know, our tenants are going to have employees as well.
Right.
So it's a little bit than just looking at our direct employment, our W-2 guys. Depending on the people we have moving in, and we're looking at hyperscale clients in the data center industry, which are the bigger guys, they're going to have probably a dozen per client, technicians and other support staff in the facility working through them as well, and they're all looking to hire local talent, and we'll be helpful, and we do what we can to help develop that local talent as well.
You've worked in the past primarily on such topics as rural broadband around Indiana and the like. Do you think that with this data center up and running, obviously it's going to take care of Northwest Indiana business and industry for the needs that they may have? Do you think that this may be a good link to be able to expand broadband service not only around our particular area but the rest of Indiana?
Absolutely. We're looking to create a hub for a lot of the broadband, expand everything to accommodate the 5G capabilities, the Internet of Things of the future. So, yes, we're looking at ways to consolidate all the area fiber optic assets into the facility to make sure that we're prepared for the future and what comes beyond the next wave of cellular technology.
Well, it certainly sounds like that with this computing data center that you're helping supervise the construction of there in Hammond, the prospect of more business in Northwest Indiana, it'll be part of all that too within the tech incubator and a lot of other things that are going to be related there on the site. It's just nothing but looking up, I suppose, right now.
Absolutely. It's a very exciting project. I'm happy to be here. We've got a great team of people. The support from the local government all the way up to Indianapolis has been fantastic. So many positives here that it's almost hard to count.
Well, Mr. Hood, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about a little about yourself and about the business, and in particular what you're going to be managing and the operations there at the Digital Crossroads at Lake Michigan as the facility gets up and running here in the months and the years ahead. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time as well.
The Trump administration wants to eliminate part of an energy efficiency standard on specialty light bulbs. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, an activist group says the move could cost Indiana households $93 in savings a year.
In 2012, the Obama administration added specialty bulbs, like in chandeliers, sconces, and floodlights, to the energy efficiency standard for lights. The change doesn't go into effect until next year, and the Trump administration doesn't want it to at all. Andrew Dulaski of the Natural Resources Defense Council calls the Obama version of the standard one of the best climate and energy policies people have never heard of.
And there's really no good reason to go backwards. The technology is as good as what you see in the LED light bulbs.
The National Electrical Manufacturers Association has opposed the Obama version of the standard because it wouldn't allow them to sell some specialty bulbs. The public has until May 3rd to comment on the proposal. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
For the third time, a large group of pigeons has been found abandoned in the same rest stop area dumpster off I-65 at the Woolcut exit. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emily Seiberg reports.
Rest area attendant Edwin Hensley discovered the birds late Sunday night, as he had twice before during his evening trash run. This time, however, the pigeons had been dumped directly into one dumpster, while the boxes in which they were transported were discarded in another. Of the 51 pigeons they found, 5 were already dead, possibly drowned in the several inches of sitting water in the receptacle.
At least give them a citation. Somebody has to be accountable, or it's just going to keep happening.
Wildlife rehabilitator Kim Hoover, who's worked to find homes for the first two batches of pigeons, called the White County Sheriff's Department for help reaching animal control. But when she didn't hear back by Monday morning, she returned to the rest area to retrieve the birds herself. Hoover says her purview is wild birds, not domestic ones, and that animal control should be in charge of rescuing and housing the abandoned pigeons instead of the wildlife centers, who have now repeatedly volunteered to take them on.
I have never heard of anything like this in my entire career.
That's White County Sheriff's Department Deputy Chief David Roth. He says White County Animal Control has handled farming animals like horses and cows, but never pigeons. Roth also contends that since the pigeons were found at a state-run rest area along I-65, they're ultimately the responsibility of the Indiana State Police. Still, he says the department plans to start investigating. In total, nearly 200 pigeons have been abandoned at the rest stop since December. I'm Emily Seiberg.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The first neighborhood that I remember growing up in was on the east side of Gary, on Massachusetts Street. And my parents brought me home from the hospital there. And I lived there until I was 4 and a half, just about 5 years old. And it was a very tight-knit community. I remember the families all interacted. The other thing about the neighborhood I remember, there were people from all walks of lives. My dad was a teacher. Across the street, my mother's best friend was my physician. We had other teachers on the block. We had people that worked in the steel mill. And all of us lived in one community. And that allowed, I think, growing up, people to see that all of these things were attainable. I think that's part of what doesn't happen today. Because once people get to a certain financial level, they tend to move away from the original community. I've never used that term, black flight, but I think there are a lot of things involved with that. Certainly people have a tendency, if they make a certain amount of money, to want to live in a different home. In this area, there are nice, beautiful homes in different sections of Gary, in Miller, for instance, even on the west side of Gary. There are some beautiful homes, but a lot of times people have felt like they want to live in another community. I think the media has played a big role in that because they have demonized this community for so long that people bought into this notion that no one wants to live in Gary and that Gary is unsafe and this is not somewhere that you would want to live. And particularly if you've gotten to the point where you want to have put a lot of money into a home, you would not want to put that money into Gary. And then, of course, we have to discuss the crime. But the crime is associated to the jobs. And so when you take jobs out of a community and you replace those jobs with guns and money, then you have something that's volatile. And as a result, then you start to, you know, have these notions that I can't live a safe life. I think the white flight really is based on racism. Purely racism. I don't care that I live in a nice home. I don't care what the community looks like, if it's predominantly black or if there's even some blacks. I would prefer not to live there and or do business there. And that is what really has happened to Gary, Indiana.
I was born and raised in Gary, Indiana. I grew up on the west side of town on Clinton Street. Two blocks from Westside High School. You know, when I left the house that morning, I was at the school the entire day. I went to school at 7 in the morning because I was an ROTC, drill team member, and I was a commander as my senior year. So I was there at 7 o'clock for drill team practice. Left from there, go to class. After class, during football season, football practice. Then after football practice, I went to karate class. So by the time I got home, it was like 7:30, 8 o'clock. So I did get home in time, was to do homework. My chores, which was wash dishes, or if it's my brother's week, he'd wash dishes and I would clean up the basement. Now over the summer, you're up, you went around the neighborhood, you played sports, you rode your bike. It was safe to ride your bike back then. But when them street lights came on, you had to be in the house or you had to be anywhere in distance where you can hear your mother calling you. That's the thing. We didn't have cell phones and all that back then. You had to listen to your voice or your mom because you could be blocks away and you hear your name. And you knew that was the time that, hey, I need to get home. And your friends did too. So you could see us all flying home on our bikes because we knew if the street lights come on, we had to be in the house. When I came through, you had all five schools. You had Westside, Horseman, Wirt, New Wallace, and Roosevelt. And each of them had a ROTC program. Each year in March, we would have the citywide competition and the whole city is inside Westside Gym. I mean, it's from the floor all the way up to the ceilings on the second floor is how it used to be. Like the Super Bowl for high school, who has the bragging rights, so we call it the number one drill team in the city. As the schools close and as the program withered away, it's not as a big deal like it used to be. We had recreation every summer. We had arts and craft at one point, learned geography at another class area. We had basketball. We had all kind of other stuff to do during the summer. And we ate lunch there amongst each other. Parents was working 8 to 4. So between the first hour they're gone, we're at home. The last hour before they come home, we're back at home. But they know those 6 hours, hey, they had recreation. And we had people who lived in the neighborhood, might have worked evenings or nights, that kept an eye on us. Hey, I got your son. He's here at my house. Don't have to worry about nothing. We was disciplined by everyone. You know, we just couldn't just say, well, my mom this, my mom that. Now, if I did it with my neighbor, then that neighbor parent got a chance to correct both of us if we was wrong. And then my mother would say that too. If you did it with them, then you deserve the punishment with them. That's just how it was done back then when I grew up, because it takes everybody to teach someone how to be. It's just not just one person or that one family. It's your neighborhood that you grew up, that you respected. That's where it comes from, like the village raising each other. Because we had the aspect of being safe. We had to worry about, okay, if we go next door, this gonna happen or that gonna happen. We believed in everybody and they believed in us and they helped raise us. As we then got older as adults, we have forgotten where we came from. In order to make our kids better, we have to provide these things for them. But a lot of us have moved on and moved away, so we're taking them things to other areas. I see a lot lacking. It's because no one wants to come here and put in the work or the effort or the money into this for some reason. I don't know why, but I mean, if I'd had the chance, I would, because we have a lot of kids who don't know that we had Beatty basketball everywhere, who don't know we had Little League baseball here and there, who don't know that we had 3-4 Pop Warner teams. It gave us, as we were growing up, something to do besides standing in the streets, hanging on the corner, or at home just playing Xbox or PlayStation all the time. We had something to do.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Some students attending Ivy Tech Community College's Michigan City Paycheck campus are going to be getting some assistance paying tuition with the help of the Meet the Need pilot project. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke with Cindy Hall of Ivy Tech about the program. Hall is the Executive Director of Resource Development at the Ivy Tech Michigan City campus. Here's the conversation.
So tell me what the Meet the Need project is.
The Meet the Need project is an initiative that was spearheaded pretty much by First Source Bank. Is they had come to talk to us about what could they do to help our students get to the finish line, meaning graduation. And essentially what happens is students take loans out for tuition. They sometimes run out of their Pell government money, and they just don't have enough money to get to the finish line or, you know, the books to take their classes and things like that.
And how does that happen, and why does that happen?
There's probably a lot of different reasons. I mean, students have, students at Ivy Tech, for the most part, are students that have families. A lot of times they have two jobs. They're coming to school part-time. They've got to pay for their son or daughter's education, and they sometimes will run out of money for themselves. And so they'll apply for financial aid. And, you know, they, whatever happens in their personal lives, sometimes it's just not enough. So what we like to think is that the Meet the Need initiative is giving them a hand up as opposed to a hand out. And like I said, is a lot of times they just run out of money or loan money, and they don't have the, you know, what it takes to buy the textbook or something. So that's where we came up with the Meet the Need. And then they just need to go to financial aid. They evaluate their records and take care of it to, again, help them get through the class and hopefully get to graduation.
Do they have to pay the money back that they get from the Meet the Need project?
Oh, no, no. This would be scholarship money.
How much money do they get?
Every case is individual. It's not a standard template. Like, for instance, if a student's tuition bill is $1,500 and they only need like $200 to pay it off and they just don't have it, then it would be like a $200 scholarship.
How do you identify the kids and the students, I should say, that are at risk?
Our financial aid department does that.
And how much money is in the Meet the Need pool?
Right now, there's actually, because of the result of the generosity of First Source Bank, there's $15,000.
And I do want to ask you real quick, because according to the news release that I had came across, it said that the RSVP was by tonight for your fundraiser on April 5th. So that's a little late would you still accept people to come to the fundraiser at the door?
Well, because it's all a plated meal. If people were to call me at 476-4710, we could still take reservations probably till Tuesday. But we're doing, everything's all pre-assigned seats. And like I said, it's a plated meal. So I actually have to give a number to the Aberdeen this afternoon.
Are you guys sold out?
Almost. We're getting there. So that's just what happens is everybody waits till the last minute and we just jockey accordingly.
How did you get the word out about this fundraiser?
We actually still do a snail mail invitation, and then we do email blast, and we do text on social media. We try to accommodate all the various ages and technology that there's out there so that different ages of people will hopefully see it.
What works best?
Well, I know some people say they can delete you in the swipe on their cell phone, and others say they really like the invitation that they can put on their desk and remember to actually send in a check. Others, you know, like the email version, and then they can just get their tickets online.
Is there anything else that maybe I have not asked you about that you want to mention about the program or about the, you know, the situation of students and paying for tuition?
Well, I think at the end of the day, helping Ivy Tech students helps the outer community. I mean, if we can keep our students enrolled so that they can continue to pursue their degree and they graduate, then they can get better jobs and then they can spend money at restaurants and buy things, and it helps support the greater good of the overall economy and sparks economic development.
Cindy, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, by all means.
That's Cindy Hall with Ivy Tech Community College in Michigan City, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. On Saturday on the Valparaiso University campus is going to be an interesting discussion, the topic of water pollution. Well, that's nothing new here in Northwest Indiana, is it? We seem to deal with these problems all the time and historically, too. And the faculty members from Valparaiso University are going to get together with other environmentally focused groups and like-minded individuals as well to host this discussion coming up on the VU campus. And we have with us one of the organizers of the event, chemistry professor Julie Peller. Julie, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your major study and research as well as in teaching is dealing with such things as environmental chemistry and the like. And water quality is one of the projects I know that you're working on the side with some financial help here in Northwest Indiana in particular, in North Lake County and probably North Porter County too, because I know there are problems there too, but mainly here in Lake County. But how did this particular idea of the A Thirst for Clean Water, which is the title for this discussion coming up, how did it come about?
The thing that I've realized in doing this work over the years, as a scientist, we can discover information, and then the question becomes, what do we do with that if we find there are problems in water quality? And I've slowly but surely begun interacting with people who are on the policy end, and that's part of how this all came about. We realized that we need each other when it comes to water quality issues and making sure that we have good water, surface water quality, and that really ignited this idea in between Valparaiso University, the University of Chicago, its environmental, Abrams, it's called Abrams Environmental Law Clinic, and just local environmentalists, as I've mentioned, Walt Breidiger, who leads the Valparaiso Chain of Lakes, actually brought us together in discussing our mutual interest in protecting water, and this kind of came about because of that.
That seems to be the major problem we have, is that we have these great sources of drinking water, one huge one, of course, at the very north end, which is, we're talking about Lake Michigan, of course, but these other sources, yeah, we have all these other sources coming in, rivers and streams and all, and they all could possibly be polluted if it's, things are not done right and taken care of.
That's correct. And one thing that we have to remember, too, is any of the areas that are part of the Great Lakes watershed, including North Valparaiso, anything that ends up in those surface waters eventually leads to the to Lake Michigan, or, you know, in the Great Lakes watershed. Mm-hmm. And so what we do around this area is what we contribute, what we put in our surface water here can affect the surface water in the Great Lakes, which so many of us rely on for drinking water.
Is it a question that you and your colleagues and others have had, not only on Valparaiso University campus but elsewhere, about not only dealing with the current problems but trying to find ways to prevent them in the future?
And I think that sometimes that our laws and our regulations are not keeping up with what we're finding in the science, and I think that's part of what we want to get across in the symposium that we're holding on Saturday. Mm-hmm. There are what we call in the science word emerging contaminants that sometimes don't get enough attention. And so this is one venue for us to talk a little bit more about some of these things, some of these pollutants that most people have never heard about.
Do we know of any of them in particular? They're just, at least right now, in such small amounts that they aren't causing problems. But as the industrial community continues to grow, that we're going to see more of these contaminants out there?
Yeah, and you know, one class of contaminants that we call persistent contaminants are those that end up in our water, in our environment, that nature really has never figured out how to handle.
Uh-huh.
And one of these that I've been focused on for the last few years, and as you've mentioned, we've gotten some funding through the EPA and through the National Science Foundation, is looking at the microplastic pollution, and namely, we've been focused on what are called microfibers. So our clothing that most of us wear that's been around for quite a while, what we often call polyester and nylon, these sorts of things. In the chemistry world, we have a different view of them as they're chemical components that get out into our environment. And just like any other plastics, these microplastics, these microfibers, they're persistent. They do not degrade. They don't go anywhere. So as we continue putting these out into our environment, they're accumulating to the extent that we can see the macroplastics, this massive pollution problem that we have. It's actually happening on a smaller scale that we can't see. And so this is an example of this persistent pollution, this pollution that accumulates. It doesn't go away because nature doesn't have those mechanisms in place.
Sort of like it's on the other end of the scale where we talk on the other end about the problems of putting plastic containers into landfills because they don't biodegrade. They don't degrade at all,
that's
actually.
Right.
They sit there and just
that's
stay
right.
there, yeah.
And so we're finding that we have these fibers that come from mostly from our clothing, from blankets, these microfibers that we've all thought have been just such a nice part of our world and having different types of fabrics and soft blankets and this sort of thing. They shed a whole lot of these microscopic fibers, and we're finding them in almost every water sample that we take from our local creeks. There have been recent studies on tap water and bottled water, in which case as much as 90% of these samples have these fibers present. So, again, these are pollution. This type of pollution that we don't hear enough about, and this symposium will give us a forum to discuss these topics and make people more aware of them.
And I know you're talking in particular here about not only the chemistry problems, the pollution problems in general, and how it can probably set up policies to deal with them too, but probably should look at ways to bring attorneys into all this and coming up with, and law students in particular, and getting them involved in finding ways to help protect ourselves.
Exactly. So that's kind of the meeting of our minds that came together. So if you look at our schedule, we have Robert Weinstock giving a presentation. We have Aaron Korn from the Hoosier Environmental Council. He's also an attorney in talking about some of that side of water protection, as well as some of the interns at the Environmental Law Clinic that will be speaking about these sorts of things. So I think that kind of makes it a little bit unique of a symposium, is that we're bringing in the science and kind of the policy angles and sort of hopefully giving everybody this nice comprehensive picture of how we address these issues.
We're talking with Valparaiso University chemistry professor Julie Peller about a symposium is coming up on Saturday. It's entitled A Thirst for Clean Water, and they're going to be kind of a discussion and a meeting of the mind, so to speak, on the problems of water pollution in Northwest Indiana. And Professor Peller, tell us about the person who's coming in and doing a special presentation, Mark Edwards.
I was fortunate to meet him at a chemistry conference about a year and a half ago, where he presented about his experiences and taking his science and really making an impact in different communities, and he continues to do that. And reached out to him and just said, you know, this is something we would love to have you talk about in this area. Water is important to us, given we're part of the Great Lakes watershed, and he was gracious enough to accept our invitation. So I'm really pleased that we have him as our keynote speaker.
And I guess he's been involved here, as you say, here in the Midwest with problems, and speaking of water problems, like the ones that are still, I guess, persisting in Flint, Michigan.
His role, I believe, was to help the people understand what the problem was, did lots of testing, had his lab and his students figure out what the problem was there. And then, like I said, the scientists do their job and then pass it on to those that you know, we're involved in dealing with the infrastructure and the people in the city. And so I'm not sure. I think that's kind of, like I said, that's the role of the science. And then we have to mm-hmm. interact and work with other people. And so he's been working on other in other communities and doing other things.
Well, it sounds like that Mark is going to have a very attentive crowd. There'll be a number of people that not only from the community, but from the legal and the scientific professions that will want to listen to what he has to say and what he's learned over the years from his work in particular.
Professor
Keller, tell us again where A Thirst for Clean Water is going to be held on Saturday, and if anybody's interested, where they can be able to reserve a seat.
Right, we're taking advantage of the law school and using the auditorium there on campus, and it begins at about 8:35. We're delighted that President Mark Heckler will initiate the symposium, and it will go until early afternoon, and so there's a registration online. If people are interested, they need to just go on to the online registration that they can get to through the VU website. And we're looking forward to, you know, having a nice crowd there.
Well, it sounds like a great discussion to bring people in on a weekend to talk about problems like water pollution, the ones that now that the weather is getting nicer, should be paying more attention to these days, to be sure.
That's right.
And Professor Peller, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it today.
Appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Julie Peller is a professor of chemistry, and one of her research areas is in environmental chemistry, and she's from Valparaiso University, where this coming Saturday, beginning again at 8:30 in the morning until 1:15 in the afternoon in the School of Law auditorium on campus, is going to be a symposium entitled A Thirst for Clean Water. For whatever reason it may be, Americans seem to see each other differently, depending on whether they happen to live in urban communities or in suburban communities or out in the countryside, for that matter, too. That is drawn based from polling and from analysis by academicians and others, that we seem to be divided culturally by geography. Well, that's what the Indiana Humanities has decided to take on in a major project that's going to basically last the next 2 years. And with us to talk about this program, which is entitled Inseparable, that's IN for Indiana, the abbreviation, of course, we have with us today Kira Amstutz. She's the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities. And Kira, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, Chris, I'm delighted. You guys are such a terrific partner up in the northwest part of the state, and happy to be with you.
Well, maybe we talk about Indiana Humanities. Maybe you recognize the organization because we have been bringing in the past year or so the Quantum Leap Initiative comments, the programs that they've come out of Indianapolis to bring to northwest Indiana. And let's talk now about the importance, I guess, of the planning that you all did to come up with this rather interesting dynamic dealing with rural and urban life in Indiana that's kind of led into the creation of the Inseparable Initiative.
Absolutely. So Indiana Humanities is a statewide nonprofit, and we work in all 92 counties across the state. And so one of the great benefits of having that kind of a wide-ranging audience is that we get out and we get to hear what people care about. And I think that particularly during the state bicentennial year in 2016, and certainly since then, we've heard a lot of Hoosiers say, you know, you hear in the media all the time that there's such a gap between rural and urban, that the issues aren't the same, that people don't care about the same things. And I think our observation on the ground is, I think these perceived divisions are overblown. And what we see is a real consistency in what Hoosiers care about, why they appreciate the state, what they hope for with their families. And so we've decided to spend the next couple of years, we have a whole dizzying array of programs we can talk about and ways people can participate, but thinking a little bit about this perceived divide and thinking about why does it matter that we as Hoosiers have a common identity, that we can come together around issues to solve problems. I know you just had Claire, Fitty, and Green on, and my goodness, the marvelous things they're doing to help fight smoking, you know, help bring down the smoking rate and work on the opioid crisis and certainly focusing on education. You know, again, I think there's so much more that we Hoosiers have in common than what divides us, and we're hoping that we can have some conversations about that.
I know that the overall aim or goal, I guess, is to be able to take advantage of the humanities. And when you talk about the humanities, of course, that encompasses a lot of things, literature, history, poetry, philosophy, other related disciplines together to help try and bring rural and urban families and organizations and communities together.
You betcha. I mean, we have some unique tools in the humanities, and one of the favorite tools that we have is certainly reading and discussion. So one of the programs that we're really excited to announce, and this was just unveiled yesterday at the State House, we were glad that the Lieutenant Governor was with us and helped us pull the curtain off the new book that we're encouraging Hoosiers to read over the course of the next year, and it's called The Year We Left Home, and mm-hmm. it's by Jean Thompson. And so for folks who like to have community reads, who have a book club, who are looking for a really good read, that it covers a Midwestern family and reasons they left home and reasons they came back and all kinds of things that happened in between. So I think it's going to be a great community read, and we hope that we can encourage lots of people to read and chat about it.
Now, with all the hundreds and thousands of books that are out there, what prompted you all to pick this particular book?
You know, it had just that sweet spot for us of covering, you know, this urban-rural question, and it's a Midwestern story. And one of the things that I think maybe not enough folks are talking about is there has been such a resurgence in terrific Midwestern literature. This is a golden era for Midwestern literature, and we were really excited to choose a book by a Midwestern author.
I know one of the nice things that Indiana Humanities tries to do is try to bring people together to talk and set up conversations of different kinds. And I know that this particular series of the Inseparable initiative, actually the two-year initiative that's underway, has a couple of these chances for people to get together in different communities to talk about. Tell us first about the In Conversation series.
Well, the In Conversation series is, it has kind of it sounds like a fancy name, but what it really is a moderated conversation series where we bring in interesting writers and thought leaders and, you know, folks that can help us think about the world in different ways. So our first one that we'll kick off next week that's part of the series is an In Conversation with Jim and Deb Fallows. They have written a book called Our Towns. And they are really cool writers. They fly their own small plane, and they flew 400,000 miles around the country, going to communities, mid-size and small, talking to people, interviewing folks, listening, and finding out what is the key to a vital community these days. What communities are responding well to change? What communities are really setting themselves apart? And what is that? You know, what could they observe that maybe other communities could learn from? And so they're coming to Indianapolis, Muncie, Fort Wayne, and Angola as part of this tour. So that's just the first one that we'll have over the course of the next 2 years. But look for other opportunities to participate in conversation.
Well, it's interesting that they should have these people with their talk entitled Our Town coming to Muncie in particular, which of course is famous for the Middletown Project, the Lens that came in and did the study back in the 20s and 30s into one particular community and how they chose Muncie to look into how the all-American community should be. It'd be interesting to see what they have to say in relationship of all these years later they see.
You are right on. I mean, that Middletown Studies program was fascinating. And if you look at a lot of national literature, Indiana has often been viewed as that, you know, kind of every town USA kind of model, that we really have been thought of as the middle of everywhere, which is actually, you know, maybe the center of everywhere.
Yeah.
So they were fascinated by Muncie. And actually, this Our Towns is a book. So if any of your readers out there would like to pick this up, it's available. It's now in paperback. But they do reference Muncie in the book, and the president of Ball State is going to be moderating that conversation, and we know all the Middletown Studies folks are going to be there. So I think it'll be a very rich discussion and certainly something, you know, something that'll be valuable to the Muncie community as they look at ways to continue to grow and prosper.
We're talking with Kira Amstutz, who's the president and CEO of Indiana Humanities, about Inseparable, which is the next two-year initiative that the organization based in Indianapolis is reaching out across the Hoosier State to deal with. And we talked about this In Conversation series that's underway first. And coming up in April, we know that there's going to be another opportunity for people to sit down over meals and talk about things. What turns into like now the annual Chew on This project. This is coming up. And one of those stops, by the way, is going to be in Rensselaer. Tell us about the program.
Oh, it is one of my favorite programs. So it's called Chew on This, and the theme of this one, not surprisingly, based on our conversation, is what divides us. So on April 23rd, you can sign up to be part of this dinner discussion series. As you mentioned, you'll have one up in Northwest Indiana in Rensselaer, but we'll have 8 other locations around the state all meeting at the same time, all having the same kind of conversation. And the way this works is you pay a small fee for the dinner, and we have a wonderful facilitator at each location who can lead the group in conversation. It's kind of like dining with strangers, but it's so much fun. And you often walk away with a new friend, a new perspective, a new appreciation for perhaps a great restaurant in your community. And I encourage everyone to check it out and sign up.
Now, kind of going along with the idea of urban and rural, we know small Indiana towns get a chance to participate in all of this over the next couple of years with a traveling Smithsonian curated exhibit. Tell us about Crossroads Change in Rural America.
See, I told you there are a million components of this program. So again, we're finding lots of ways for everybody to plug in. So we are incredibly proud that we were able to work with the Smithsonian to bring this exhibit to Indiana. And it's called Crossroads Change in Rural America. It is going to help the communities that host it think a little bit about how rural America has changed over time. And then each community that's hosting will be able to create a component of the exhibit that's very personal to their community and their place. And right now we have, there are 6 hosts. And the way this program works is the communities that host it need to be smaller than 15,000. So this is a tremendous opportunity for our smaller rural areas to get to host a museum quality, amazing exhibit with the support of the Smithsonian behind it. So the 6 sites are Dillsboro, Indiana, or the Aurora Public Library in Dillsboro, Washington County Historical Society in Salem. We have Jennings County Historical Society in Vernon. Up north, we've got Elkhart County Historical Museum in Bristol, North Manchester Center for History in North Manchester, and then finally one other Southern Indiana site, the historic New Harmony. Folks will be hosting it. So this will happen between September of this year and June of next year. It's a beautiful exhibit. Each of the hosts will do tons of programming around it, have speakers, have tours, have lots of opportunities to engage. But again, we're really jazzed that we were able to talk the Smithsonian in to bring in the exhibit here.
And I know the information here that the Indiana Humanities has put out talks about not only having an opportunity for people to see exhibits and talk about the issues, but filmmakers can get involved in putting together some work as well, too, to bring these stories of rural and urban and suburban Hoosiers together. Tell us about the film project.
Well, the film project is very exciting, and this is where we are looking for creativity. So if you know a filmmaker out there, will you please have them contact us? All of your listeners, please, filmmaker in your life, have them connect with us. We are looking for filmmakers who can help us understand the rural, urban, suburban dynamic in Indiana, and this is why we need excellent storytellers. These are going to be short films, but again, we will. We have a call right now for filmmakers, so if you fill out the call and we select you, we have resources that can help you put your film together. And then we did a similar project recently with the focal point being the White River. And not only do we help support the filmmakers in making the films, but when they're done, we have film release parties. We share them widely. It's a really great way to tell stories, which is a big part of what the humanities do. And we're incredibly excited to be able to involve filmmakers in this journey.
And we know there are a couple other points, too, I'd like to bring up that will get the public involved in the questions that will be brought up during this inseparable two-year initiative. One of them is a poster, and the other are getting speakers lined up. Tell us first about the poster program that's going to be underway, and then about the Speakers Bureau.
Okay, so if you are working in a school or a library, no worries, it's going to be automatically sent to you. And so one of the things that we like to do with our themed programs is create some kind of cool visual poster that helps illustrate some of the information and the facts that we're, you know, kind of basing the conversation on. So this particular poster is really cool. It helps us understand the changing demographics of our state over the past 100 years. And it's beautifully done. We worked with Muncie Map Company to create it. Some very talented folks there, and it is free. So if you're interested in getting one of these gorgeous posters, you can contact us at indianahumanities.org, our website, and request one, and we'll send it to you. But if you are with a library or a school, we will send them to every school and library in the state for free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the Speakers Bureau is something interesting. That's something brand new, I understand.
It is brand new, and I spent a lot of time yesterday going through it's essentially a catalog online where if you would like to bring in a speaker to think about any of the issues that you and I have talked about today and more, we have what's called the Speakers Bureau. So we have a catalog of speakers. You look through that. You say, oh, my gosh, that speaker idea sounds amazing. This person sounds amazing. I'd like to host them at my school, at my community center, at my neighborhood meeting. You apply to us to host. It's a very short application. You say what speaker you'd like to hear and basically when. And then if we select your community to be a host, we'll pay for that speaker to come and present. And your job is to get folks there and to make the most of it. So it's a really wonderful opportunity. We're delighted to have enough funding to do that. And there are dozens of speakers in this catalog with some just incredible talks. So please check it out and let us know if you would like to apply.
Once again, Inseparable is a two-year Indiana Humanities Initiative. It invites Hoosiers to look into how we relate to each other across boundaries, whether they're real, whether they're in someone's imagination or whatever, and to be able to look into what it would take to become inseparable in all of the ways that seem to matter. And this initiative is like many of the others that the Indiana Humanities has had. The last one that we've talked about, and we've actually had programs on the air about, was the Quantum Leap program, which kind of dealt into STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math, science, medicine fields. What kind of response can you tell us that you have received from this past initiative that just ended?
I'm so grateful that you ask. And again, thank you so much. It was wonderful being able to partner with your station to air. If you heard the Quantum Leap sound bites, I know we had some of our audio storytelling that appeared on the station, and I think that was a fun element of the program. But just as a quick snapshot, we did a statewide read of Frankenstein. So our book last year was Frankenstein. It was the 200th anniversary. We had over 600 programs statewide that
That's
reached
right.
thousands and thousands of people. I can't even begin to tell you how much excitement there was out there for thinking about that book, thinking about the impact today, how we think about the limits of science, how we understand, how we understand our world and otherness through that book. And it was really magical to celebrate Mary Shelley's book 200 years later with such a big party.
Well, now, Kira, you have time left just to tell us what the website address is and where people can find out more in particular about all of these elements of the Inseparable Initiative that will be taking place now.
Well, the best place to go is to our website. That's indianahumanities.org. And you can find links to all of the programs that I've mentioned. And if you have any questions at all, there's a staff list. Reach out to us. We'll be happy to help.
That's Indiana Humanities CEO Kira Amstutz. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.